Poisson algebra of phase space functions based on basically one curve, which we can take as an edge, and its dual curve. It was like something maybe like this. And so we found that this gives you the phase space. And this phase space is known as a T star SU2. If you don't know what this is, that doesn't really matter. And so what we have to do is to quantize this phase space, and then we would at least know, have a Hilbert space where at least the observables associated to this one edge live. And then there's a standard technique, which is you take basically tensor products of all these Hilbert spaces to get a Hilbert space, which basically allows you to do or to encode information on lots of edges, which will form a graph, not very surprisingly. So basically, that's what we have to do. We have to quantize this phase space, which means that we have to do three things. One will be basically to find a representation of our observable algebra. Means a quantum representation. A second is that we need an inner product, and this inner product should behave nicely with respect to the action of these observables, because eventually you want these observables to be, for instance, self-adjoint or unitary. And once we have done that, we will also discuss an basis on the space. And so, okay. So basically, what you might know is that T star R is just a standard phase space for a particle, and you know that this ends up to be a Hilbert space L2R, where basically the standard representation would be that X act as multiplication operators and P as derivatives. That's something which I will usually. And so having T star SU2, we basically do something very similar. We basically want to first represent the action of these holonomy operators. Now, as is indicated here, holonomy is not a function in itself, it's a matrix element, it's a matrix. So what we have to consider is basically functions of the holonomy. Which then, however, means that these are functions from the group SU2 to C. And what we want to represent is these functions as operators. And so, naturally, taking this analogy, and of course, there's a. Afterwards, you can justify that with abstract theory. One decides that these functions should act as multiplication operator. So let's consider states which are functions on the group. And we want these functions f to act by multiplication. And so what happens with multiplication, of course, these commute And so we actually managed to establish this fact. Here we have that matrix elements of the holonomy commute. Matrix elements are nothing else than functions on the group. Clearly they map to C. And here these multiplication operators also commute. If you take two functions, and so we have consistently managed to somehow represent this thing. Also, we haven't actually defined what the Hilbert space is because we haven't really defined what the inner product is. So that was the simple part. Let's look at this other part, which looks a bit more complicated because it's a slightly non-trivial Poisson bracket where we have something non-vanishing and non-constant on the right-hand side. And so let's check what happens there. Okay. So basically, let's look at this Poisson bracket in more detail, and let's actually rewrite it. So let's check what happens if we really take actually here the Poisson bracket of a matrix element, so really of a function of a flux and this function of the specific function of the holonomy. So then how you should read this thing is that you take the matrix element of the product which is on the right hand side. That's the only consistent thing to how to read this. Now this happens to be actually something can rewrite this as a derivative of HE times the group element and so this group element is defined to be the exponential of t times tj. So tj is a Lie algebra element. If you exponentiate it, you get some element of SC2. And so you take here a one parameter family, and then you take the derivative at t equal to 0. And this is actually defined to be the so-called left invariant derivative, left because it's invariant under left multiplication because nothing happens on the left. So this left invariant derivative is associated to this edge, which in this context is a bit empty statement because we just consider one edge. And so this left invariant derivative is basically a derivative operator which acts on functions. So here technically this acts on this function, which is defined to be the matrix element Mn on the group. And similarly, if you take any function of the group, so that would be actually functions of the group elements, of the matrix elements. So then, basically, by Leibniz rule, you would find that this is the left invariant derivative of this function, and this is in the same way defined as above. So you take basically, you multiply the argument from the right. This is one parameter family, and then you take the derivative of this. Okay, so that's good. We understand basically that we can represent this Poisson brackets actually as an action of the flux on the right entry, and this action of the flux is basically the action of the left invariant derivative. So now there's basically the standard trick. If you really want to represent, to argue that what could be the definition B of the action of the flux. So let's try, let's assume we have given an operator which is a multiplication operator which you get by applying a left invariant derivative with a component J to a function Fe. And so let's apply this multiplication operator to the state which is a constant function. So this is supposed to be the constant function. Maybe with a normalization, which would be volume of the group, but actually the normalization will be such that we will define a measure so that this volume is actually one. Okay, and so then what one wants is that we know that this is the right-hand side of this Poisson bracket commutator. So this can be written as the quantization of these Poisson brackets applied to the constant function, which I want to be represent, or this is just the fact. Actually, that what one wants is that this is given by the commutator of these things in the Poisson bracket. So it's a quantization of E and the quantization of F applied to the state. And now I basically can write out the commutator. So the first term is flux acting on multiplication on the result which I get by acting with the multiplication operator on the constant function. If I act with the multiplication operator on the constant function, I basically get kind of the function itself as a state. And then I would have this other term. Which would be this one. And here, this is actually something which turns out you could change. So you can also define a representation where this is non-zero. It has to be a bit careful. But in this context, you say, OK, these should be actually derivative operators, and let's define them that they annihilate the constant functions. So we define this term to be zero, and again it's actually subtle that you could define them, these things, to be non-zero, but we define them to be zero. And then what we have achieved is, in fact, we have figured out what this flux operator should be. On a function Fe, because here we have the flux operator. And here we have defined a state, because this would be just the state as a left invariant derivative acts on this function. Which I rename into psi e. So with all these constants, I define this to be the action of the left invariant derivative on this function psi e. And so we have checked, we define this action of the flux operator with a motivation to represent this Poisson bracket. And so we checked it on the constant state. However, you can check for yourself that it actually applies to all states, that this would be correct. Basically, because the Leibniz rule holds, which I usually forget how it's spelled. Or Poisson bracket relation. It's correctly implemented on all states. On all states, where we haven't really defined what all states means. But we will do that soon. And the Leibniz rule just applies, means that the product gives you the product rule for the derivative. And so we have managed this one and this one. And so we would have also to manage this one. And again, this will be automatically, you can hope that this is automatically correct because of the Jacobi relation, which actually we used as a motivation for this Poisson bracket. And indeed, we should maybe check that this holds. So again, it's if you have never seen that, then this is something which can be checked explicitly. But if you have seen some stuff about Lie groups and Lie algebras, this is actually just a fact about left invariant derivatives, which represents the Lie algebra commutation relation, as we will see. And so you can check that explicitly by really writing everything out. And we check this, sorry. On these phase-based functions, Mn, and actually I have to specify here, I assume the fundamental representation 1/2. You can do that for any representation J here, for instance. and later we will see that this indeed gives you a basis of our Hilbert space. So now we can basically expand in the lowest order in S and T. And you will find that the constant terms, of course, cancel each other. and you have basically only these terms which have a linear part in S and a linear part in T at the same time. And these will come with different order, Tj, Tk here, Tk, Tj here, there. And so, in fact, you get the commutator of these two basis elements on the right hand side. You use a commutator relation which gives you an epsilon and the Tj, you rewrite this again as a left invariant derivative, and so you in fact find that this is given by epsilon jkl left invariant derivative acting on the group element. Okay, and so we see that this TL actually just stands more or less for a derivative operator. And so it's clearly related to the momentum conjugated to the scoop. Okay, so we managed to find basically something which indeed gives us a representation of our chosen algebra of observables. And so we were very lax so far, because what we haven't, what we have so far no idea on is actually the main ingredient of a Hilbert space. What do we need for a Hilbert space? Inner product. And then it shouldn't be an arbitrary inner product, because we want these operators to be at least symmetric or self-adjoint, or the, you know, actually the holonomies will be kind of defined to be matrix elements of unitary operators, so they are not necessarily self-adjoint because they are really complex functions in general. But let's look at the fluxes. So the fluxes we really want to be self-adjoint or a priori just symmetric operators. So self-adjoint means something more than symmetric, but it's a bit harder to check. And symmetric just means that you can shift your operator in the inner product from left to right and from right to left. Okay. And so we have seen that the fluxes are represented by these left invariant derivatives. So the left invariant derivatives, derivative is something which is just actually the, we have defined it even as a derivative of a certain flow on the group. And so you could also do that with a standard derivative. and this flow, you know, it comes from multiplying your argument of your function from the right. And so we can define actually an action two actions of the group on, as we will see, it will be our Hilbert space, basically, but on functions of the group. An action means actually these really will define your representations. So we have a group element, and then we can define the left multiplication acting on a function of a group. Gives you a new function, which is defined to be f h minus 1 g. Now I write h minus 1 here, because one wants to have this to act as a representation, which means if I would have LH1 times LH2, I want this to be LH1 times H2. And so if you apply here another LH prime, you would have to apply this really on the argument. So that is, you don't write it here, but you write it here. That changes the order, and you need a minus one for this one. That's the left multiplication for the right multiplication. So that is multiplication from the right. You know, exactly the other order applies, so you don't need an inverse to get it really also as a representation. So the same relation has to hold with L replaced by R. and these define you basically two actions of the group, and obviously we have that we defined a bit confusingly, but you know, and everyone does it differently, of course. The left invariant derivative to be the derivative of the action with respect to right multiplication. And also we could define the right as a right invariant derivative, and this is the flow of the left multiplication. And sometimes people also put some minus signs somewhere. But we define it this way. Okay. And so we see that the fluxes are infinitesimal versions of these actions, and where these actions are actually exactly the exponential versions of this. And so what if you exponentiate a self-adjoint operator, what do you get? Actually, exponentiate I times the self-adjoint operator. Yeah. So indeed, so what you want, what you can hope is if you manage that these operators act unitary on your group, then you manage to have actually self-adjoint operators. If this unitary group defines you something which is called a strong operator family, strongly continuous operator family. But never mind. So unitary means that this operation should preserve the inner product. So what we need is basically an inner product which is invariant, inner product. And this will be functions on the group. So the inner product will be basically defined by a measure. And this should be invariant under left and right multiplication. And so measure means if we define our inner product of two functions, psi 1, psi 2, in the usual way, that you want psi 1 g. Let me check if I have a consistent here, apparently. psi 2 g, and now it's not very obvious. I mean, I need to choose coordinates on the group, and it's not a Cartesian manifold, so I have to choose something which is usually called the measure on this group. And so I want this measure to be invariant on the left and right multiplication. And indeed, there are groups where you can't have a measure which is invariant on the left and on the right multiplication. Luckily, SU2 is not, that's not the case for SU2. So for these nice, basically for compact, semi-simple Lie groups, this measure is unique. And it's called the Haar measure. So let me define you this Haar measure. So there's a nice general theory about it, I mean about compact Lie groups, but I will just motivate how you can get the Haar measure in the case of SU2. And actually then we will never need it again. So what we what we claimed at some point is that SU2 can be mapped to the 3 sphere. And in fact, this left and right multiplication on the group rotates the 3 sphere around. So basically what we have to do is to use the 3 sphere coordinates as our coordinates on the group and to write to define a rotation invariant measure on this 3 sphere. And so in fact at some point we had this parametrization of G, which was with an angle alpha that happens to be in 0 to pi and with a normal vector A. So that was kind of, I remember correctly, something like that, modulo factors, which I might have forgotten, that this gives us G. And N is a unit, so that doesn't mean quantization, it just means normalized vector in R3. So then we can basically parametrize our normalized vector with, again, two other angles, psi and phi. And then one writes something which basically is completely equivalent to like the rotation invariant measure on the 2 sphere. So now one does it on the 3 sphere. And this is what it turns out to be, where one normalizes the measure such that the constant function on the group has integrates to 1. So the nice fact about SU2 is actually that it's also compact. So note that this allows us, like on S1, to have the constant function on the group to be actually integrable. And so this Haar measure, so sometimes people write a little h here, so this is basically this the same thing which appears here, d mu g, so now it's just dg. So formally, dg prime. It's invariant under multiplication. It means that you can basically transform any group element. An argument of the measure can multiply it with g, with h from the left and from the right, and you get the same measure. So g is an integration variable, h would be another kind of constant group element. And so that means that kind of the Jacobian here for this transformation would be 1. And so this holds for an arbitrary g from the left and from the right. And actually, it also holds that you can change g to g minus 1, and the measure is still the same. Okay, and this R measure uniquely defined with a normalization that this is integrated over 1. So we define the space, Hilbert space over 1 edge. Now with this measure is called this, the space of square integrable functions over the group G, which in this case is SU2, with the Haar measure. So that's our Hilbert space. And so now we have defined the Hilbert space, and we can ask for an orthonormal basis. And so this Hilbert space is a more complicated version of the unitary group in U1, which is S1. And you can also define a Haar measure there. And you have seen what the basis. There's a nice orthonormal basis there. You might have seen. Which is the basis you know from Fourier decomposition. So these Fourier modes are orthonormal and if you orthogonal, and if you define the right normalization, which means you would have to divide d phi by 2 pi, these things are also orthogonal, orthonormal, I have norm 1. So this is an orthonormal basis. And actually, these things also happen to be to define one-dimensional representations labeled by K. Because obviously, I mean, one-dimensional representation means that just the fact that these things product of two group elements gives you the representation, the product of two representation matrices, which happen to be one-dimensional, gives you the representation matrix of the product of the group elements, and this product of the group elements is defined with the Engels edit. And so in this example, one basically can say that the orthonormal basis is given by choosing an irreducible representation from all equivalence classes of irreducible representations you have for S1, which actually happens to be exactly labeled by K. Irreducible, so which is called an irrep. So this is labeled by K, and then we take actually matrix elements, all matrix elements of this irreducible representation, and in this example, they happen to be one-dimensional, so that gives me just one group element, one function per group element. And so this nice thing actually generalizes. So for a compact, compact semi-simple Lie group, where we just need to know now that the SE2 is such a nice compact semi-simple Lie group. There's a theorem called Peter-Weyl theorem, and basically that says that the matrix elements of irreps, of irreducible representations, form an orthogonal and actually also normal basis . And if you want also normal, then you need to normalize them slightly. As we will see, and that will be by the square root. So we can define basically these basic elements, basic states, basis states, in this bracket notation, and the bra G means that we evaluate this basis state at this funny state G, so at psi, that means basically psi. Sometimes you can also write psi J M G. In any case, this is defined to be the matrix element DJ M N G, where J is the label of our representation. And we have also this normalization. And because of this normalization, we need to multiply with the square root of the dimension. So this is the dimension of this representation, which is called VJ, of this representation space VJ. Okay, so this statement means that first of all, these things are orthogonal So you get 1 over dj. That's why one needs this thing, and one gets lots of Kronecker deltas. And so actually, in proving the theorem, this is the one thing to show. And the other thing to show is that you have actually complete bases. And this is quite simple. This requires a bit of analytical arguments. And here I already write you lots of information about these representations of SE2, which I have seen, which I hope you have seen at some point, but we will just go through it. So completeness of the basis means that these things give you the identity of your Hilbert space. Okay, and so here we introduce already this notation. So there is basically SE2 representations. And as you know, they are basically labeled by half integers. If you have these half integers, you have these magnetic indices, which go from minus j and then in steps of plus 1 to plus j. And so this gives you 2j plus 1. And so these are representation matrices acting on these 2j plus 1 indices. So the dimension is 2j plus 1, which is defined to be dj. And then technically, you can basically get spin j representations by taking the spin 1/2 representation, which we just introduced as a fundamental representation, and taking the tensor product of these and actually symmetrizing this tensor product. And then you get basically the largest things. And in fact, that defines you DJMN. So technically, provide you a formula, which we will never need again. There's some normalization going on coming from the permutation group, from the symmetrization. Here, there, you have permutations. And here, in fact, you take the product coming from the tensor product. Of the same group elements, and you permute the first index of all these group elements and apply and sum over all permutations here. Okay, so we actually see that, in fact, these group elements, the representations give you kind of higher polynomials in the basic matrix elements. And having all these higher polynomials, indeed, is the main argument to argue for the completeness of these of the states. So there's a Weierstrass theorem that tells you that polynomials at least then are dense in these spaces, L2, in L2 spaces. Okay. There's a nice exercise. Which you can actually do now with this knowledge. And this exercise has first a definition, which we will need at some point, which is the character of a group of a the character J of a group element. So it's a function on the group, and it's defined to be just a trace. Of the matrix elements in the J representation evaluated at this group element. So these characters, I mean, first they really just depend on J. They don't depend on the so-called member of the equivalence class. So if I say representation matrix G, J here, I need to choose, I make to make certain choices. Those are equivalent representations. And the equivalent representations, however, will basically be connected via a unitary matrix. However, this is the trace and the unitary matrix I can commute through, and so I will get that this is independent of the thing. And for the same reason, this trace, of course, is a so-called class function. Class functions are defined to be functions which are invariant under conjugation. Okay, and then there's this nice thing that you can represent the delta function on this group, dj, where delta function on the group is defined in the same functional way as on R. So if you have dj g, and the delta function on the group is defined to satisfy this definition. And in fact, the exercise is to show that this is in fact satisfied if you take the trace for all j's, so sum here over all j's, j equal to 0, just write j here, and you sum over all characters, and usually I from and you multiply with the dimension of dj. So we have this orthonormal basis. As you know, this orthonormal basis is the Fourier basis, and it's nice for certain aspects. And so, in fact, our orthonormal basis is also nice for certain aspects. And so it actually has nice properties with respect to left and right multiplication, which means it would have nice properties with respect to left and right invariant derivative operators. And so we can check what is a right multiplication on a group, on a matrix element. So I have defined this function DJMN, and I check what is this new function, which is defined to be the right multiplication of this function. That's obviously DJMN GH. And so here, one uses effect that DJ is defined to be a representation, which by definition means that I can write this as a product, as a matrix product of these representation elements. Sorry. And so I get this result. And so I can define operators which act on my basis. And they lead to a superposition of my basis states. And the coefficients in these superpositions is given by these matrix elements evaluated on H. You see, however, that basically this index, I mean, first of all, J remains the same here, and M remains the same. So basically, this right representation, we have said it the right multiplication from the right, have said it defines your representation of the group. And so here we say that we actually found invariant subspace, and this invariant subspace is labeled by J and M. And this right multiplication actually acts in the J representation. Now there's a question if it's the J representation or the, in the J representation on these states. on, so, it acts as DJ on L to G on a subspace. On a subspace which is labeled by J and by M. So for every J and for every M, we have one subspace. So that means that for a given J, we have actually 2J plus 1 subspaces in there. And so you can make the same with the left multiplication. And so something similar will happen, just that you have a minus 1 from the fact that the left multiplication was defined by a minus 1. But we have also a subspace, which now is concerns the other two indices, or J and the other magnetic index, the right magnetic index. And it acts also on this representation DJ. But there's this funny thing that it's DJ here. There will be, if you compare this, here you sum over the first index, here you sum over the second index, and you have an inverse. And so, in fact, this is defined to be the action, at least on the basis, of the so-called dual representation, also called contragradient representation. So this is defined to be dj star, and dj star nn g is defined to be the matrix, the representation you get, so the representation matrices you get is dj, you commute these two indices, so it's a transpose, and you take the inverse. And so that really comes from also if you use the inner product from taking from shifting the hoop action to the other entry of your inner product. So this defines you a priori, it's a different representation, J star, but in fact it turns out that this representation is unitary equivalent to J. And where do I have this formula? So actually, this unitary equivalence is given actually by another group by dj evaluated on a very specific group element epsilon, and epsilon is 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And it's an element, it's a 2x2 matrix, which happens to be both in SU2 and in the Lie algebra SU2. Okay. So what we have found is that the right multiplication gives me 2j plus 1 representations vj, which are in L2G. The left representation gives me 2j plus 1 representations vj star. And so what it actually means is that the Hilbert space, which we are discussing, decomposes into a direct sum over J. And so for each J, we have vj's, and actually we have the dimension, we have 2j plus 1 of them, so that's actually the dimension of vj star, and also the other way around. And so actually, if you have these group elements j, n, m, we can understand this in having a spin J representation here and a spin J representation here. Because it's exactly these indices, magnetic indices NM, which are acted on by these left and right multiplication, which under the derivative become the left and right invariant derivatives, which at some point we will actually see really act as angular momentum in the spin representation. Okay, and we will need that tomorrow to discuss our first geometric operator. Not tomorrow, but on Monday. Okay, thank you.